to Saturday Supercast, Episode 3. Today we're talking with Scott Neely, the artist and writer on the upcoming Sugary Cereals comic known as Alfie. We also talk a little bit about some of the licensed work he does for DC Comics as well as Warner Brothers Entertainment, and a little bit about his teaching and also his upcoming appearance at the Baltimore Comic Con. Enjoy!
Hey, wake up, it's another beautiful day. Sit down, cause it's time for the best breakfast. And all your friends are here to stay. And hanging out, just because. Where do you go to get a bite to eat? It's so delicious. Friends are there. Hey, where do you go to get a snack so sweet? It tastes so lovely.
Hi, welcome to Saturday Supercast. I'm Jersey Drozd, artist and writer of The Front, Equalizers of the Divide, a whole bunch of other comics, and with me today is Scott Neely. And Scott Neely, I'd give you a list of how many books this guy works on, but seriously, they'd take the whole show. But it's safe to say, if it's a licensed property at DC Comics, Scott has probably drawn it. We're looking at Scooby-Doo, Cow and Chicken, Johnny Bravo, Courage the Cowardly Dog, Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy, Powerpuff Girls, Ed, and Eddie, I Am Weasel, Sheep in the Big City, and what else? Whole bunch. So, Scott, welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, actually, a lot of those. The only ones I've really done for the comic book stuff is actually the Eds, of course, Scooby-Doo, which I'm working on now, and Courage the Cowardly Dog, and a little bit of Dexter. Everything else is pretty much all through the licensed property stuff. So people will probably see my art out there in other places as well, outside of comics, for t-shirt designs, whatever. You might see characters on.
Okay, but Powerpuff Girls is published by DC. You just didn't work on the books.
Exactly. I did artwork for that back in 2000 for product design when they first came out.
Well, we can start there, because I do a little bit of this stuff myself, not for these particular licensed properties, but I do freelance work on properties where I am part of my job is to match an existing style. And yep. not necessarily bring my style to it, but you know, ape this other style. How hard do you find that? I mean, what's the peculiar challenges in that?
Basically, you get these model sheets that you get to work within. I'm pretty well tempered with doing it. I've been doing it for these kind of licensed properties since '99. In November will be my 8th year with Scooby.
Wow.
Specifically, he's been my main nut, so to speak. The rest of them have kind of come and gone. I mean, I've worked on enough of different licenses where they get phased out after a time. I'm doing some Ed, Edd n Eddy still because they have a DVD movie coming out that's directed DVD, so they're still keeping them going. But Powerpuff Girls and Dexter's Lab and Courage was phased out earlier this year to make way for the new stuff that's on now at Camp Lazlo and such. Cartoon Network. Grim Adventures, Billy and Mandy, that stuff is keeping going as well because they just came out with that movie on DVD, but that's going to be phased out soon. But basically, it's not you have to have the right temperament for dealing with that kind of stuff. A lot of artists, especially artists who do comic books, because I'm coming from the opposite side of Warner Brothers, so to speak, where everything has to be on model. Most comic book artists, if you draw Batman, Jim Lee can go in and draw his version of Batman, and they'll just say, okay. And my version of Batman would normally have to be based on the Batman Strikes or the Batman cartoon, as it's called, on TV right now, and everything. They give you the model sheets, and it has to be very strict is in terms of what they're going to approve. I tried to reach out today to get some new stuff with DC based on the new JLA toy line that's out for DC Super Friends. And I was told pretty much that they want to keep me on the Cartoon Network stuff because they're having problems with guys keeping on model and getting stuff approved. It's taking longer because they have to do redraws and stuff like that and return the stuff back in. So.
Right. Yeah, that's something that I found too, where if you're working off a model sheet, if you're even, 5% off on an eye, they'll get you. and they'll make you do it again.
Strawberry Shortcake back in 2004, that was the worst, and the Bratz, that was the worst. Well, there was two, but Strawberry Shortcake was the hardest, because not only would Deke, who owns the license, American Greetings, also co-owns it, so you'd have two separate places putting in their 4 cents worth on every drawing, so it would get tweaked quite a bit on stuff. But you just have to have the right temperament. A lot of guys don't have that. You know, you have to give it over. It is their license, in a sense.
Right, right. Yeah, it's a job then, and it's not about expressing yourself as much as an artist as it is about expressing yourself as a craftsman, I think, in that situation. Like, the thing I always think of is, you know that Simpsons episode? Every artist, I'm sure, knows this episode. The one when they introduced Poochie to the lineup on the Itchy and Scratchy show.
Yeah, actually, and I don't know much of the Simpsons. I'm like the one guy.
Oh, there's a scene where they're showing the artist designing the new character, and there's this group of people, you know, like the investors and Krusty the Clown and all these executives behind him yelling over his shoulder saying, no, he's got to have more attitude, make him 10% more Rasta. You know, I've experienced situations like that where you've got, you know, like a team of people behind a project, and you get like this list of notes, and then they put it to a focus group, and then you got like this voluminous tome of changes to do to the character, and sometimes it'll be something really vague, like make him 15% happier, you know.
Oh, I just had that on the Scooby-Doo stuff I did for Scooby-Doo Style Guide stuff. It's him as a fireman. I had drawn this stuff, and they thought Scooby was too aggressive for the younger set. I was going to use the drawings. But they were all done in Adobe Illustrator, so I was able to go in and redraw his face and redo it to make it a more positive thumbs-up Scooby, like he's giving the thumbs-up. But in some of the shots, he was holding an axe, which firemen use. And they said, well, the axe has too many sharp corners on the front and the back, so we have to redraw that, and then we would substitute it with a hose. So there's like three different versions of like one drawing.
Wow.
That was toned differently, that they came in at the last minute with stuff. But that's all for like product stuff that you would see on T-shirts and stuff like Scooby to the Rescue and stuff of that nature. When you do that kind of licensed art like that, they get pretty picky because they want to try to make it for everybody, especially for the littlest kids to teenagers, you know, where it'll pick up.
That my entire perception of any kind of products with licensed characters on it completely changed the moment I started doing any kind of work like that, because I realized now when I see it, it's like, you know, that took probably 30, 40 hours to create. It wasn't just one illustration. It was one illustration with two dozen changes.
Yep.
And, you know, and like an entire committee of people deciding on what that thing looks like. So that's just staggering to think about every time you see like a Spider-Man coloring book at the grocery store or something, you know.
Yeah, it's occasionally some of that stuff they let slip by, because some of the quality on some projects is really, they hardly touch a hand to it. They just want to get it done to a certain extent. And then other properties, I mean, there was a time for the comic book stuff where they were sending the artwork up to AKA Cartoons for Ed and Eddie, because that's a studio up in Canada that actually produces the cartoons, and they would critique it as well, Cartoon Network.
And wow.
They would actually do little redraws and stuff, and they would have guys who work on the show. A lot of times now they're getting guys who work on the actual shows to do the comic book end of a lot of stuff, just for quality control. That's the key. I mean, for the longest time, they were trying to, you know, guys could be looser in a comic book. It was more about the story and just moving the action along instead of staying on model. They were more forgiving that way until certain aspects of Warner Brothers change and they want to keep the product exactly, you know, the way they want it, which is kind of the way, you know, they want certain things. Like now with Scooby-Doo, they kind of disavow that, you know, Scrappy doesn't exist.
And yeah, you
see dumb. And
you sent me a cover to a Scooby-Doo book that you did, and I'm looking at it right now, actually, and it's like a Christmas scene. You got Scooby kind of laying in front of the fire, and he's got one eye open, and he's frightened. In the foreground, there's this monster hand lifting one of the cookies that were left for Santa. But over the fireplace, I see a stocking for Scooby, one for Shaggy, one for Scrappy. And they made you take that off, didn't they?
Well, I added that as a gag. I've been, for since like 2000, I've always... I even be working on Scooby before, when they had the traditional look, when Freddy had the ascot and all, and I would try to sneak Scrappy in as a gag, whether I was working on like a sticker book for somebody. I would do like one extra sticker with like Scrappy holding an ice cream cone, or doing the puppy power with his arms posed up, and just as a gag, just to throw it in, it was always, you know, you always get the thing back with a huge X through it. Like,
wow.
Just because they disavow that, you know, we don't deal with that anymore, you know.
Well, that was after Infinite Crisis. That was that was Earth 2.
Well, you can't
character.
Even fix the licenses. And you figure Warner Brothers owns DC and Batman, and, you know, it's part of Scooby. It's all kind of under that umbrella, but they don't want to mix the licenses, which is why you'll never see Scooby-Doo and Batman again. They've actually nixed all that from ever happening. I can't even draw a kid in the background with, like, a Batman logo on the shirt.
Wow.
Far background. They don't want anything to mix with the licenses. Even Blue Falcon and Dynamite teaming up with Scooby, that'll never happen again.
Oh, man.
Yeah. This is kind of a shame because I thought up some really cool ideas we could do. The only thing I can actually get away with is doing stuff from a pup named Scooby-Doo when they were little kids, and you can mix that in with, like, flashback. You can use that license, but anything else has to be very specific. Even Scooby-Doo in terms of the Mystery Machine, if you have a writer who, specifically in the comic books, they'll come up with the Mystery Machine and they want to do some kind of like a Hummer vehicle up in the north that go through the mountains and snow and all that, and it's going to be the Mystery Machine. And basically, you know, before I draw anything, I just call Warner Brothers Licensing and go, no, we here at Consumer Products, we like the Mystery Machine just fine the way it is. Just dirt and snow tires on it and chains on the tires and that's it. And so they do. There is a lot of control. I think one of the nicer things about doing the art, for me, I've been doing it so long that the stuff gets approved. That makes it easier for DC in terms of, like, you know, when the new guy got into approving Scooby-Doo, he would, you know, he would have really harsh notes for, you know, like Joe Staten and other guys who were, they've been drawing it, but they've been drawing it so loose. And the guy who was approving it was a hardcore Scooby-Doo fan, and he wanted Scooby to be the exact same height that he should be as opposed to Shaggy, and little flaws that he was really, you know, that I kind of knew from working in the licensing end. I was already dealing with that regardless, you know, and not having too many bad tangents and within the art. The comic books is a much different thing than animation.
Oh, yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, and the neat thing is for freelancers like you and me is that when you get a client and you get a sense of what their sensitivity level is, it's easy to stay on the job. They'll come back to you because they know they're not going to have to give you a whole bunch of notes. And I had that happen with the job where the client said specifically afterwards, you know, this is the only guy that we want to draw these characters because we know what we can get from him, because they don't like that X factor. They don't want to have to send out 7-8, you know, sheets of notes to new guys all the time. So that is a wonderful
word about that way. Yeah, that's what is kind of cool in a sense, but it does pigeonhole you after a certain point.
No, you're absolutely right.
You can draw other stuff, and it's like, well, you're a Scooby guy, you know?
Well, and like you said, even as gratifying as it is to feel like, oh, you're necessary for this machine to work, it's not as creative a job, say, as comics is, because, yeah, you are trapped in this notion of Shaggy has to be exactly this many heads high. And if you deviate from that, you know, you're in trouble. And if it was your own comic, you can do whatever the heck you want. In Euclid Comics, characters are off-model all the time by little tiny degrees, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't change the reading experience.
A lot of times, like, I think it's the, especially with comics, it's the turnover rate. I mean, I've had the thing where comics is really like a Polaroid. You take it today, it's printed tomorrow.
Yeah.
With everything else I've ever worked on with Scooby, before I even got into comics back in 2002, when I approached DC about doing some Scooby stuff, I mean, everything I had done was literally like 8 months to a year in advance by the time I finished it. And then they would just print whatever they were going to use it for style guide art I had done for like a style guide for like Scooby in Love. And you do all these kind of pictures of Scooby with hearts and stuff that they would put on stuff later. All that stuff is literally done way in advance. And most companies work that way. I just did some work for American Greetings right at the beginning of the summer, and that stuff, they were putting to bed their fall of 2008 line. And they're starting now on their, you know, spring 2009 line.
Wow.
That's how far ahead these major companies work, whereas comic books, you're talking like 2-3 months in advance, and in case of the last Scooby I just did the full issue on was the movie adaption for Chill Out Scooby-Doo, which came out this month. And I had gotten that at the last minute. And it came down to, you know, trying to get reference and stuff for it. And it was, luckily, I know people at Warner's Animation because DC couldn't get the reference for me. And otherwise, it was going to be a movie adaption I would have had to make up. Scratch. And luckily, I made a few calls and got the producers on the line. So, I mean, that you're working straight from models and you get the storyboards and you're trying to work off of that, which is hard, and tell the story at the same time. And I really had complete control of that, in a sense, which was actually really kind of nice, but I had to organize all the coloring notes, everything, to make sure it was going to be dead on. The best part of the whole thing was getting me in touch with the animation department for Scooby out in California, where they could see my work and go, oh, okay, maybe we might be able to use you in the next film.
For this Wow.
So that actually was the bonus of the whole deal. But it was, you know, and with comics, it was started like a month and a half, and then it came down to like, you know, 3.5 weeks. Because it was getting moved up. And that's the problem. I mean, it's done so quick, and I think that's where a lot of comic book licensed material fails, because some guys have to pump out a whole thing really quick, and it's just not going to happen sometimes. It takes, because you have to allow 2 weeks for approvals. Cartoon Network now takes like 3 weeks for approvals to do stuff, to get it back to you, and then all of a sudden, well, it's hurry, hurry, hurry.
Yeah, I've had that experience plenty of times with working with work for hire situations where you've got a committee that needs to approve it, and so you've got like the 6 month window, and then you do the comps, you do the first wave of stuff, and then you're sitting on your hands for 3 or 4 weeks, and then they wait until like you got about 3 weeks left, you know, and it's like, oh, guess what? It's all approved. Here you go. Just make these two changes.
Yep. I mean, the strawberry shortcake. But, I mean, there is bonuses to it. I mean, a lot of times they don't give you anything. I did work late last year, early this year for Mickey Mouse Clubhouse and Winnie the Pooh. I mean, Disney didn't give me anything. They gave me a couple of sheets to work on, and it was like, here, just use it. They figured, you know, you worked on all these other licenses. I'm sure you can do it. And luckily, it all went off without being any critiques or everything was approved out of the gate, which was really cool. And because people talk, that's how I got work doing some stuff for Shrek the Third, because it's all word of mouth. And go, oh, here, use this guy. He's pretty good, you know.
Right.
But like I say, a lot of times guys that don't have the patience to deal with other people throwing on tracing paper on top of the work and saying, here, move this over a hair, do this, do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's up to the last minute with these little changes. And I think it's all about just having the right temperament to be able to deal with it, because it is their character. I mean, they're paying you to draw, you know, their stuff and have it be on model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You have to put your creative, the artist inside of you with the beret and the mustache, you have to put him in a different part of your brain for a little while you're doing that kind of stuff. Because, yeah, I remember my first couple times getting notes like that. I did, my hackles raised, and it was like, hey, who are you to tell me, blah, 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 you know? But, you know, eventually you just have to learn just to be cool-headed and professional about it. That is the key to doing that kind of work.
I mean, some guys have such a distinct style, like, say, Scott Roberts, and he'll do his comic strip Patty Cake, which is his character, and which is a tremendous book for kids. And but he'll do Courage the Cowardly Dog on the side. But when you look at it, it looks like Patty Cake's eyes on Courage and stuff. I mean, it's just such... It's not like Courage the Cowardly Dog. It's more like Scott Roberts' Courage the Cowardly Dog. It's a style. I mean, and that's when you get into the licensing end, because I've dealt with, I can't remember the guy who created Cow and Chicken, but I remember the stories where he couldn't get in to do his own characters in terms of licensing art, because his art was so loose and stylistic and stuff. He wasn't allowed to draw his own characters in terms of product design and stuff.
Oh, wow.
I think it was David Gleiss, I think, who created Cow and Chicken. And he was, you know, it was one of the hardest things. You know, it really is hard when you get in that. And then all of a sudden, now they all want everything drawn in Adobe Illustrator, because it's all got to be vector-based, because we're going to, who knows what we're going to put this stuff on.
I was wondering if we could get into like a little bit of an art geeky area here, like an area where maybe the average listener isn't going to care so much, so I'll warn them about this. But I'm really curious to know, when you're drawing in Illustrator, Mm-hmm. What's your process? Because, I mean, Adobe Illustrator, for those who don't know, is a vector-based illustration program, which means that it is not like putting ink on paper. Ink on paper is more like Photoshop or a raster program, where it's like you're pigmenting pixels with ink, with a darker color. Whereas with Illustrator, you're actually plotting out vectors or mathematical plots with like Bezier curves on them that you can adjust.
Which is exactly why it makes it great, so you can blow it up. And since it is based on mathematical equations, you can blow it up to the side of the Empire State Building and the resolution is still be perfect.
And it doesn't change the file size at all. So
nope. One of the greatest things, but it's a bear trying to master it. All the Strawberry Shortcake artwork is created in it.
Wow.
All the Disney stuff. I had done color work for the pen and inks I had done for Disney. I knew they were going to do in coloring book stuff. And then I had to recreate the work using that black and white in a template and then creating it all in Illustrator, just which would be used for products because everyone's kind of going towards a more 3D Pixar type of CGI look for all their stuff now. And but for the tech stuff, Adobe Illustrator, the reason why I prefer to ink in it instead of Photoshop is primarily because it has to be vector. Basically, with my tablet, I have a 12 by 17 drawing tablet that's plugged into the hard drive. And the problem I have with Photoshop is if you hold the pen just slightly above the tablet, you're going to get a little sense of movement there, which is really makes it hard to maintain a straight line. Whereas if you draw on Adobe Illustrator, it'll compensate for your arc. If you're, Photoshop will pick up every little dip and blip of your hand.
Right.
And it'll be on the paper. And a lot of times you don't want that. You want the super smooth, slickest line you can do. And with the Illustrator, it'll compensate for that based upon your settings and your pressure and everything else.
And you can adjust the tolerance of that, too, how much it's going to smooth your line. So you could have it be very true to whatever kind of irregularity is going to be to your line. But you can also set it so that it will actually correct it quite smoothly.
Yep. And so. Actually, most of the – I had a template that I used for the Scooby cover I sent you with the Christmas thing. And pretty much all those aspects were all done in Illustrator. The tree in the back, the fireplace, the cookies, the plate. Because basically trying to do a plate and then put it on that perspective and then trying to do it by hand, even with French curves and ink it and all that, it's just so much easier to do in the computer, which I never understood why they do the Powerpuff Girls, you know, on paper for the comic books. I would just do it in the computer because they have a lesson step-by-step on how to do it that you get from Cartoon Network. That's how they do it. It's all done in Illustrator. And it's like, you know, just follow that and do it. But the problem with doing this is, of course, you don't have, in terms of the comic book stuff, you don't have any artwork to resell. And to a lot of artists, even like myself, you can lose thousands of dollars a year by not having the finished artwork on official DC paper, although I did get away from DC paper because they've had bad batches of it of late, and it's just hard, bad to ink on.
This is something that's happening more and more as more artists are switching to like getting those Wacom Cintiqs or the new mod books, you know, where you can or even any kind of like digital tablet, tablet PC, where you can actually draw right on the screen. More and more people are starting to do that, and they're finding, well, yeah, what do they do about original art? They can sell prints, but you know, that's just a printout.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, most of my stuff I can't do that because I don't own the characters on the stuff. It's just work for hire. So when you have your own character, it's the best way to actually to do anything in terms of the quality. I mean, you can put the best comic book inker, you know, Carl Story, Mark Farmer, I mean, any of those guys up against an Illustrator inked line, and I'll take the Illustrator line every time. Because you look at it, when you scan that thing in, you look at it 400% on your screen in Photoshop when it's blown up, and you see that perfect line. I mean, it is absolutely, you can zoom in 1,000%, and that line is just super crisp in every form. I mean, that's just incredible. Because when you work in licensing like I do, I mean, everything has to be modern. I mean, you can't walk into Nickelodeon if you don't know the computer end of it, you know, for Illustrator, Photoshop, and, you know, maybe InDesign or Quark. I mean, you have to know those three specifically, but especially Illustrator and Photoshop, because Blue's Clues is all done that way, and Fairly Odd Parents, they all went vector-based, and books, and they reuse the art for other stuff.
Very true. Yeah, I mean that like I was saying, that's something I'm finding in the work for hire stuff that I'm doing, where they want to just pay for the illustration once and then repurpose it on, you know, 10 different things. And it used to be, I did a billboard illustration back in like 2003, and I mean, it was on a billboard and it was a raster file, and that file was gigantic. And I think I was on dial-up at the time when I was trying to upload that thing on FTP. So I remember hitting send at like 8 o'clock the night before, and then 9 o'clock the next morning it was still going.
Wow.
You know, so yeah, it would have been.
When we first created the Hollywood Hound, Rhinestone Out, and we came out with a music CD, and I did it as a throwaway. Little did I think it was going to evolve into this empire that we're building. And I remember Scott Innes called me, and he says, we got a billboard. We're going to take the front art with the characters. We're going to blow it up and put it on a billboard. And I'm like, oh, man, I wish you would have told me that from the beginning, because I would have taken Illustrator to begin with. It was
right.
Photoshop, and it was like I blew it up on my computer. I thought, this is horrible. I said, so I had to go back and redo the whole album cover with the characters back in Illustrator a whole second time.
Oh, man.
Billboard. And then after that, everything else, pretty much I was doing vector-based, whether it was art or what have you, just for that sake of blowing the stuff up, because you just never know, and it's just a safer bet to do. There's a guy, Brian Denham, who does that new Iron Man comic out, which is 100% done in Adobe Illustrator.
Wow.
Which is really hardcore. I mean, those are the guys I love to hang out with and talk, because that's really where it's going in the industry. You can get so much more work if you're computer-based. I'm not saying you have to do everything in the computer, but if you know well-rounded enough to do, be able to do stuff of that nature, it's, you know, it's really advantageous to your career, especially comic book guy. This is like the same industry where I'll talk with Kyle Baker, and it's like he's so into the computer and doing stuff in Flash and everything else. And guys are doing stuff from 70 years ago.
Yeah, Kyle Baker's stuff, like I just read his new one of his new books, The Bakers, and that you could tell there was a lot of computer work in there, and it was used to very good effect. I mean, I didn't look at it and go like, ah, computer, he just cheaped out. No, he was using it for very, very unique effects. But Baker's always been like that, though. He's always been pushing edges where other people haven't.
Plastic Man, the first issue, the Plastic Man, that was all done in Illustrator. And he had that already in Flash because he was pitching those issues. They were actually like storyboards for a Plastic Man cartoon. And he had ulterior motives that he was pitching for the stuff. Even if you see him at a show, you'll see that Baker's artwork animated in Flash.
Hmm.
Because he just did it for these other purposes that he knew he was building on. So it wasn't just for the sake of doing a comic book. And I think that's really kind of important. I've had many discussions with the guys about the Alfie comic, whether or not I should just ink the thing in Adobe Illustrator and do it that way, and do everything on a separate layer. So that way, if it hits and I'm doing licensed art, I can just pull the characters off of one layer and use it for product art, because it's all inked in Illustrator, so you can vector base it all.
Mm-hmm.
And do the background plates is like a separate thing. And just have it all as like color form. You have the background, and then you overlay the characters on top, and then just color it and add word balloons to it, and there's your comic. The bonus to doing that is you can get maximum use out of your art. And of course, it slows down the process a bit, but I mean, those guys, I talked with Matt Haley about that, and he's pitching his own stuff as well, and he's very computer literate in terms of, you know, doing a GI Spy and getting his own stuff going, and it's like, yeah, man, you ought to do that, you know, because you have ready-made stuff. Otherwise, you have to go back and redo it.
No, yeah, you're right. I mean, it may slow down the initial process, but the inevitable payoff, the amount of time you save in the long run, is going to be huge. And that's something that, to my own extent, I've been a big fan of in terms of like for my webcomic stuff, building downloadable files. You know, like little putting your character on, essentially, you know, licensing your character to yourself, where you make bookmarks, you make downloadable printout files and stickers and things like that. If you've got it on its own layer, then you don't have to redraw it. But before we get, I mean, you've already mentioned two different projects that you're involved with that I want to talk about. But before we get to those, I just want to wrap up this Illustrator thing by asking you, what tool do you wind up using the most in Illustrator to ink with, quote unquote? Are you using the brush tool, or are you using the pen or the pencil tool?
Actually, the pencil tool. Sometimes I'll use the brush tool for certain aspects of a drawing. But mostly you can get away with a pencil tool just fine. Especially Illustrator 10. That is the best pen tool or pencil tool to use. They went to CS, they tweaked it a bit, and it, for some reason it's not as good as it used to be. So for that stuff, I do use Illustrator 10 for using that pencil tool within that program. CS is good for stuff. I hardly use it, though. I pretty much everything I do is like still in Photoshop 7, or because I love the brushes in Photoshop 7. In the pencil tool in Illustrator. And basically, I mean, there's still guys who color comics who are still in Photoshop 4, which I don't see, but the CS stuff, for some reason they change stuff that works really good, and then they screw it up, and then it's not as good to use anymore, and then you got to find out, you have to either go back or wind up using a lesser program in terms of using certain aspects that you need the computer to do for your given project. I mean, a lot of times, you know, guys want to do some kind of filter effect or something in Photoshop, and you can only use it with the new CS stuff it comes with. But for most of my stuff, I can get away with Photoshop 7 or like Illustrator 10.
Well, I'll have to mess around with the pencil tool a little bit more. I'm just starting to get my feet wet with the drawing in Illustrator. So I was using the brush tool just because I was getting a better line values out of it. But I'll have to monkey with the pencil a little bit more and see what I can do.
Yeah, it's all about your settings and about your pressure sensitivity.
Okay.
It's playing around with the speed of your mouse that you would have, and then you're playing around with the speed of the pen in terms of if you draw slow or compensate for that, and then you got to play with the point at the end of when you have your stroke line, if it's going to come out to a sharper point or it's going to have a slight roundness to it. I mean, there's variables, and there's never been a class or even people I've talked with out at Warner Brothers. I mean, everyone has their own little settings for everything, but yet the work all turns out the same way. Which is appropriate at once, you know.
Well, we'll have to see if we can't get you to do some kind of a video podcast instruction for how to use Illustrator.
Talking about, because Mike Manley wants me to do an article for digital inking for a Draw magazine. He's been after me for a while now to do that.
There you go. I'd be interested in reading that.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, next, you mentioned Hollywood Hal and Rhinestone Al and the Wannabes, or with the Wannabes. And this was a project you were spearheading with, how do you say Scott's last name?
Scott Inez.
Inez. Yep. And I didn't know he was the voice of Shaggy. It's not Casey Kasem anymore?
No, he's doing it for pretty much everything across the board. He had done it in 2000, Casey retired from it, and then Scott did the voice in the Cyber Chase movie. He did Shaggy and Scooby, and then after that, Casey, he was one of the stupidest moves Scott ever did. He called Casey, because he's a Casey fan. He called him up and said, hey, I replaced you. I said, what do you think of my voice, you know? And he did Shaggy, and Casey was like, hey, Scott, Casey Kasem here. You done Shaggy and me real proud. And like 2 weeks later, Casey comes back. I guess he felt like, oh, man, who's this young guy taking over my gig? And he came back, and I said, oh, man, what did you do that for? That was, like, the stupidest move. He said, well, I'm a fan, you know. Man, you're killing me, man. So, like, he said something with Casey's daughter, must have said something that goes, hey, I hear your dad's not doing Shaggy anymore. And she's like, Dad, you're not, you know. And he went up coming back. So now, but Scott does the voice for Shaggy and Scooby for everything, the video games, the toys, Fisher-Price. He just had a session with Fisher-Price, all the ringtones.
Oh, wow.
He does like 50-some voices. He does like Fred and Barney, Mickey Mouse character, Winnie the Pooh. I mean, he does a ton of stuff. So he's still keeping active in it. It's just trying to get him back into the voice thing for doing a lot of the movies and stuff like that. We would have talks about, you know, it's like, look, you're drawing. I'm drawing this thing, and, you know, you're working, doing the voice on Scooby. There's no equity in this stuff because you don't own it. You know, you're just making Warner's millions of dollars, but at a certain point, you know, it's cool to have your own thing.
And that's when you guys came up with Hollywood Hal and Rhinestone Al?
He, for the last year, he met me in like 2004. He found me on the internet when he was surfing one night. He puts in Scooby-Doo, and I'm like one of the first names that comes up because nobody else really puts down that they do this stuff. And he just contacted me out of the blue, and he's like, "Hey, how you doing, Scott Innes?" You know, we started to be friends. I do some work for him on the side, and because he's down on the radio down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and we would do a like promotional for Clear Channel. He'd get me jobs doing T-shirts for Clear Channel and stuff for Mardi Gras and giveaways and stuff to the radio station for work. And he always said, "Well, I'm going to do a children's CD," because he had released his own songs and stuff like that. And all the DVDs that you get with Shaggy and Scooby songs that are on the box set of DVDs and stuff like that, I mean, they're all Scott singing and doing the songs. All the soundtrack albums for like Scooby-Doo and the Witch's Ghost, all that stuff is all Scott.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to do a kid's CD. And that was the extent of it. Well, I said, okay. So every 3 months, I'd ask him. I said, you know, he's still going to, because he wanted me to do the CD cover for it. And I said, well, okay. And I kept asking him every 3 months. He said, no, I'm still kind of working it out. Don't know what I'm going to do yet. And another 6 months would go by. And finally, it was like the end of 2005, December. He called me up and he said, I got Hollywood Hal and Rhinestone Al. And he just said, you know, I want a director, old school director, maybe holding one of those things he speaks through, and, you know, some boots maybe or something like that. And the other guy is going to be right there now. He's going to be like a cowboy, kind of like an Elvis singer type. You know what I want? Do it. And that was it. He just gave me free reign, and I thought, all right, whatever. I whipped these characters out on first shot. And he's like, great, that's it. And the background that I did for the first CD was actually, I thought it was such a throwaway. I used a background for a Bratz property that I used. And I just tweaked it quite a bit, but I used all the basic stuff I created in Illustrator and just used the same stage and everything because the colors worked and everything else. And I just used it for Hollywood Hound and Rhinestone Al on our first CD.
Huh.
And we came out with the first CD, and the next thing I know, you know, it was like, I'm getting suits made. He's like, you're getting nothing? He said, and the next thing you know, he's like, he calls me up and goes, yeah, guess what? I got a TV deal. We're going to be in the CW in Baton Rouge. I'm like, the CW? You know, it was Smallville? Yeah, we're going to be in the CW Saturday mornings. And they moved this to Sunday. And I'm like, oh, man. You know, and all of a sudden, that's when this stuff started kicking off. Cause I'm thinking, oh, man, if we were planning for TV, and I said, I would have known if I had an inkling what he wanted to do with this whole thing. So it was like I would have designed the characters differently, because the problem is Al originally, the way he was, it was like in a white Elvis suit. So that was white, but then we got like a Porter Wagner cowboy suit, which is now blue with the rhinestones. And we got one of the guys who designed all the Elvis suits, and that's who everyone, all the impersonators go to get an Elvis suit. And so we went, everything's top notch in terms of production, but the color on that, we put them in front of the green screen because Hollywood Hal is all green in the suit coat. He gets lost on the thing. And if you put them in front of a blue screen, now Al gets lost because of his blue suit. Oh, man, I would have designed this completely different because now the separation. And then we're talking about the puppets. And, you know, we get the wannabe puppets we had made. And now we got Mr. Ratty, who's our ratographer, one of our characters now. And so basically, I got to do like all the artwork for the TV show, all the green screen artwork behind. And tonight I was working on an ad for City Social Magazine, which is down there. And when you get down to Louisiana, it's like it's from one end of the state to the other now. And we're slowly picking up in September. We just started in Pensacola, Florida, and Gainesboro, Florida. We're now airing every morning 7:30 on Cox Communications, which, I don't know if in your area where you are, I have Comcast.
It's Comcast where I am, but I used to live in the Southwest. It was Cox down there.
Oh, yeah. So Cox, they took off down there, and Cox, like, loves the show, and they ordered another 10 episodes of the show.
I watched a little bit of the video on the website, and I think this is interesting that I think this is what sets you apart from the other people on board of Sugary Cereals, is you are definitely – your work seems to aim at a much younger audience. You're not leaving them out, and you're specifically kind of letting them in with your stuff. I mean, Alfie is the same way. And I know that you've talked in the past about your passions for the Spidey Super Stories that the Electric Company used to put out.
Yep. So there's this literally Hal and Al is pre-K. I mean, it's 2 to 5 year old. That's what we have. That's what that is basically built for. I mean, I learned to read through Spidey Super Stories growing up in the 70s, and then through reading them and introduced the character, even though it was really watered down Spider-Man, there was such a charm to that whole series of books that, I went back recently and bought all 57 issues again.
Oh, wow.
I have them, and I've got a full set now, and I loved them. They're great. They're still great.
No, they are.
Fun.
They're a lot of fun. They are so much fun, and there's no baggage whatsoever. It's just, and you're right. It's a very pared down version of a Marvel story. I remember I've got a couple issues, and one of them is Silver Surfer shows up, and Dr. Doom's up to his nefarious tricks as usual. So he's trying to get the people afraid of Silver Surfer, but the dialogue is like, "Run! It's the Silver Surfer. He might be mean."
That's right. Which is great for little kids. I mean, that's one of the things with DC's new line of kids' books. I mean, even with Scooby-Doo now, they want to make it so wordy for adults because that's where the comic book market is right now. Everything's written for adults. And when Hollywood Hal and Rhinestone Al was approached, I mean, it was for pre-K, and there is just a huge market for pre-K stuff. And a lot of comic guys, I really don't talk about Hal and Al. There's only a couple guys who know about it, and they kind of get – I mean, they're really cool with it. They think this thing's a bomb. It's going to be the hit. I'm going to be rich and all this stuff. And a lot of guys who are comic book guys are coming from this more adult thing. They'll look at it, and they'll just kind of – you'll get that eye roll going, you know, and it's like, oh.
Really?
Yeah, amazingly.
That's really interesting.
You can't see the forest for the hills. I mean, there's such a void for good children's entertainment. They want to do everything for teenagers or whatever, you know?
Yeah, teeing up. And I remember one of the reasons I invited you to join Sugary Cereals in the first place was because I heard you on Comic Geek Speak, and you were almost, when you were talking about this very subject, you were almost foaming at the mouth. You were getting so, you know, kind of passionate about this idea that, look, comics can be for everybody. And I'm in the background with, you know, pom-poms going, yay, Scott, way to go.
I will tell you, this is one of the sad parts about Mike Wieringo. You know, he was just so unfulfilled and so miserable at the last part of his life before he died recently at 44 of a heart attack, was that
right. He
wanted to do his own thing, and he was working on and Marvel, for all the stuff you read on Marvel.com, how great he was, they didn't know what to do with this guy. Because I know the whole inside story for this last project, and they pulled it from another artist and gave it to Mike, and it was a debacle. They didn't know what to do with this guy because he had a fun style, and if you get writers who write too dark, it's not going to work.
Right.
Fantastic Four stuff, Mark Waid wrote to his strengths.
Yeah.
It's fun. And that's what made Fantastic Four such a great book. Unless you get a good writer who does that, it's not going to happen. There's so many comic books. I mean, I love Daredevil. I love the whole Bendis, Brubaker stuff, and that's only on now. But I'm reading this stuff. Yeah, great. I'm early 30s, you know, and it's like, this, you know, this thing ain't happening. I can't give this to a kid.
Right.
It is way too intense. I mean, the one prison graphic novel where, you know, Bullseye, Daredevil, and Kingpin are in prison, I mean, this would make like a great HBO show. But there's
right.
no way I could give. I mean, you go back 10 years to any comic book, it was still kind of all ages. For some reason in the early 2000s, it changed over somewhere within the policy that all this stuff, for some reason, we can't sell it unless it's for adults. And I've been in enough comic stores down south where I walk in now and it's like, hey, you know, Scott Neely, I do Scooby-Doo. And it's like, hey, that's great. Don't have any of it. We have no kids comics at all.
Wow.
They can't carry this stuff at all. Not even an Archie Digest. I mean, they can't sell it because they don't get kids who come in.
And that's the weird – I don't even know what the word is for it. That's the weird recoil effect of comics becoming more like blossoming as an art form, as a literature form, and that you get all these wonderful books like, you know, American Born Chinese by Gene Wang and Derek Kirk Kim stuff, all this really breakthrough stuff that's really thick and complex, and that's wonderful. I'm so excited about it. But then it seems to be happening at the expense of everybody's running to that, and everybody's running away from the kid stuff.
I'll tell you that Mark Waid has said about his guys who come up to him at a show, and they'll say, I love your Brave and the Bold comic. It's so much fun.
Yeah.
He hates when you use the word fun because that means it's a death knell of the book. I'm serious. We say it's fun. That is the worst. It's like not even like bad means good. I mean, it's like,
right.
Forget about it. Your book's going to get canceled because it's like you
right.
Can't say that. It's a fun book.
It has nothing to do with how he personally feels about the word fun. He just knows that if that word is spoken too loudly within the vicinity of editors, the book's going to get canned.
Yeah. It's the beginning of the end. Because the mentality
like saying,
is make these. I always go by the old rule, and I'm sure you do too. Every comic is somebody's first comic.
Mm-hmm. That and, Jim Shooter thing.
Yep. And it's like you have to make it accessible. And I've been in comic stores. That I deal with, and Captain Bluehand. I'll be sitting down there on a Saturday, and a mother will come in, and she'll pick out like 6-7 comics, bring them up to the counter, and I'm sitting there with Joe Murray, the owner, and we're looking at them, and you know, and he'll be like, "Oh, I wouldn't give this to the kid. This is a Marvel Knights Spider-Man. This is more adult." And then the other ones are all middle of the 6-story arc stuff. So he
yeah.
doesn't get what's going on. So we had to go back and pick out Spider-Man comics that would be all age friendly. And
yeah.
like 10 years ago, and you pick up a spectacular Spider-Man that Sal Buscema did.
Yeah, yep, those are the ones. I finished teaching a semester at 5 different Detroit public schools where I was teaching comics to 3rd and 4th graders to help improve learning comprehension. It was part of this big literacy arts comic book project from ArtServe Michigan. And my boss said to me, as part of the project, she brought a whole bunch of comics that she bought at a local store to like distribute to the classroom so the kids would have reading materials. And what was really astounding was that you're dealing with 10-year-olds who have never read comic books, which just blew my mind. But second of all was when she told me that, she said, "Oh, I've got this huge box of comics we're going to give to the teachers." My first immediate knee-jerk reaction was, let me look at those because I don't know if all of those are going to be okay. She's like, "Well, what do you mean? It's like Superman, Spider-Man, Batman." I'm like, yeah, I know. But let me look at these. And thankfully, what was really wonderful was that the comic shop proprietor was smart enough to give her a whole bunch of stuff like Old Fury of Firestorm from the 80s, Cloak and Dagger, and you know, Spectacular Spider-Man, all that kind of stuff. And then mixed in was a whole bunch of stuff like Teen Titans Go, Justice League Adventures. So to my relief, that was...
There was no All-Star Batman in there, right?
No. There was no Grant Morrison titles. There was no Planetary was not in there. But what was really cool, as an epilogue to that little story, is that I watched kids discover Firestorm for the first time, and they're like, "I don't know who this guy is, but he's awesome because his head's on fire and he can turn things into things."
Yeah.
That was cool. It was cool, but it was also kind of it was a little saddening at the same time that like, oh my gosh, this was their first exposure to comics, and they're like already 10, 11 years old. It's amazing that it's not in their lives as much as it could be, like it was for us.
The major part of it is there's so many distractions in today's world, but the comic book industry is so insular in and of itself that it doesn't think outside the box in terms of all they let is the licensing in terms of toys or the movies.
Mm-hmm.
But these movies do not bring in any new readers. The last time a movie brought in readers was 1989 when Batman came out with Michael Keaton. That
right.
time I saw people going back into stores, the bat craze hit again, and Batman was all over the place, and people were going into stores to read Batman. Now Spider-Man does not make them come into the stores. I mean, it's still a small market. And the way Diamond works, being the only distributor for books, I mean, they go by their sales. I mean, I've had people who looked at me and go, "That's Scooby-Doo, it doesn't sell. It sells like 4,000 copies a month." And I said, "Yeah, to you. I mean, that's, you don't even know what the whole print run is. I mean, it's gone down a little bit, but back like 3-4 years ago, Scooby-Doo and Powerpuff Girls there were more print run to Scooby and Powerpuff Girls than Jim Lee's Batman. They printed more than that.
Wow.
The biggest sellers. I said, "You're never going to see that in Wizard magazine, ever." I mean, because they just don't want to ever acknowledge it. And Looney Tunes is the hottest seller over in Europe. Those comics that you see from DC Comics for Looney Tunes are done 3, 4, 5 months in advance because they take them over to Europe and it sells like hotcakes. They do these hardcover slipcase editions for the Looney Tunes comics over in Europe.
Well, now we're talking about the way Europeans treat their comics, and that's a completely different animal than we treat them in the States.
But it's just a perception over here. If you go, oh, it's a Bugs Bunny comic. I mean,
right.
If you take kids' comics over here, and I'll tell you, DC has no respect for the Johnny DC artist or anything else in terms of that line. They just, the upper echelon of the company doesn't care about the kids' market. The DCU is where it's at, and they'd rather have their infinite crisis of the 52 whatever going on, incomprehensible stuff that's not marketable. Look, I'm an adult, and I can't pick up 52 and know what's going on. They're so different entity.
Yeah, I grew up on DC. I mean, my introduction to comics was reading Silver Age stuff when I was a kid, and that's not a reflection of my age. It was just that's what was available to me, and so you know I had Silver Age stuff like the Justice League versus Kanjar Row, and then I had Crisis, and then I had like the whole collection of Who's Who, and yet still when I was reading Infinite Crisis, I was like, huh, okay, what's going on in this panel here? So, yeah, I mean, that was even cutting me out. It was really, it felt like, okay, only people with a thesis on the DC Universe need apply to read this book is how it felt to me. And, you know, that's fine. I mean, that's cool that there's stuff that really pays off the big geeks. And you're seeing that a lot in television right now with shows like Heroes and shows like Lost, where it's like if you don't sign on from day one and go back and watch them all, you know, you're out of luck. I can't go watch an episode of Lost blindly and know what the heck's going on. And that's its own kind of fiction. And that's really cool. But I don't understand why it has to be at the expense of other kinds of fiction. Where, you know, especially like when you look what's happening in books right now with the kids market and the young adult readers, like the Harry Potter thing, it's huge. So it seems like, okay, comics, it's time for you to get in there too. And Tokyo Pop's filling that void nicely. You go to any Barnes & Noble.
Yeah,
you know, look at the table of all the manga.
The Marvel and DC section has gotten smaller, and the manga section has exploded. You know, and
yeah,
where it's at, cause girls are picking up and reading those manga digests now. They don't pick up Wonder Woman or you know the DC stuff.
Right, they're hungry for fiction and comics fiction. I've been teaching some classes at some of the local libraries and. Of all the comics classes I taught the teenagers, the ratio has been about 10 to 1 girls to boys. There's this huge explosion of young girls interested in this art form and in comics content, and that's where I feel like manga has really eaten American comics lunch. But I haven't seen anything from the Minx line yet, so I shouldn't talk too definitively.
Well, they're going to get behind that. I think it's basically... With the classes I'm teaching now, there are girls who are in there who want to draw manga, and that's the dream is working for Tokyo Pop and all that, and just doing that that kind of taken off in that respect. But the worst part is with all of this stuff, and I know you talked about when you go into the schools and you have these young kids who don't even read comics at age. I mean, there was a thing a couple months ago, I think I sent it to you, where down in Maryland. They have the school districts are now are introducing comic characters into their learning, into the curriculum, in a sense, where now Disney is creating material where you have like Winnie the Pooh and Mickey Mouse teaching kids to add, because it adds another whole learning thing. Mm-hmm. I'm reading this in the newspaper, and I'm like, well, where the hell is Marvel and DC? They should be at the forefront of this.
Mm-hmm.
How cool would it be for a kid to sit there and say, oh, I got Spider-Man. He's walking me through multiplication.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 2x4 or whatever. And it's like, you have him there, and it's going to help the learning process a lot more and make it fun, I think, for kids.
I think it helps them retain the knowledge as well. Like, I'm speaking from my own personal experience. Like I said, I read a lot of Silver Age stuff when I was a little kid, and I read The Metal Men. And we all know who the Metal Men are from DC Comics. You had tin, iron, gold, platinum, mercury, right, lead. And they were all robots that had the properties of those chemical elemental metals. And when I started learning about chemistry in the periodic table later on, I was like, oh, my gosh, these are those characters in that book. And that's why they had those symbols on their chest. And suddenly I was very plugged into the content because I had something that I was already interested in that this related to.
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, for the non-traditional learner, for the kid who doesn't necessarily think rigidly, structurally, and mathematically, for the kid who has a wandering mind, tying it into something that they already care about is a wonderful way to get kids, to keep kids plugged in.
problem is that a lot of kids read today either. I mean, that's a major part. Even college kids now. I mean, they just don't want to bother to pick up a book. It's true. I mean, they'd rather somehow kind of visual learning. They just don't want to bother with it. I mean, I learned to read through Spidey Superstores. My mother could tell you to this day that when my teacher called my mother and told her, your son is reading. And it was because of Spider-Man. And I had like Spidey Superstories, and I was able to read it there in the class by myself and tell her what was going on, and I could read the dialogue. Mm-hmm. Even though it was simplified, two to five, whatever it was for that age limit, I knew what it was, and that was a big deal. And, you know, it was part of that thing with, you know, with Spider-Man. That's what, you know, that's kind of where I say the comic book crack habit began, and it started back then. And there's nothing like that for kids today.
Yeah, and that was part of what was the part of the idea behind why I wanted to start something like Sugary Cereals in the first place, was this notion that the mainstream, quote-unquote, industry, American industry of comics, doesn't seem to be very aggressively trying to get them while they're young. And like you yourself just described it as the comic crack habit began for you at that age. And it can't begin for kids when it's so aged up that it's only for teens and up. So you need those entry-level books. Even if some people sneer at them, that's fine. Go ahead and sneer at them. But these are the entry-level books that got to grab those kids. And you never know when you're going to find that kid who's going to read comics for the first time, and he's going to be a quiver ever since, right? You know, he's going to read that one book that changed his life. Like, you know, for me it was Blue Devil and Amethyst. Those were the books that I read when I was a little kid. And I was like, this is it. This is what I want to do. I want to spend my entire life on this stuff. So you never know when you're going to get that kid. And then you get them while they're young. So you need those entry-level books, and that's kind of like where you and I have constantly seen eye to eye. So do you want to take that as a cue to talk about Alfie a little bit, your upcoming project for Sugary Cereals?
Yes, actually, that spawned out of basically my real dog, who's actually right here next to me right now. And that's actually more of a surreal thing when I work on it. You know, and he's like curled up on my arm in front of the computer because he's there, right there, and he's kind of like overseeing everything. And it's kind of the cool thing about it, just working out the logistics of it and doing it. The first time I did the sketch for Alfie, I started like, I think, 11:30 p.m., and literally it was 5 a.m. in the morning when I stopped working on this stuff. I'm like, oh, man, I got to go to bed. It was like the most creatively fulfilling thing I had done in like literally years.
Wow.
There was no holds barred. I could do anything I wanted to do. And that has to be the absolute kick to anybody when you just do your own thing and you own it. I mean, it's your deal, you know, and that is without a doubt the biggest thing. I mean, I see so many kids who are like, oh, I want to work for Marvel DC. I want to draw Batman. And it's like, okay, that's great. But as I get older, I'm like, you know, do the Dave Sim rule, like, you know, forget Batman, draw Ratman,
mm-hmm.
pick them yourself, and use your own characters, because it is ultimately more fulfilling. It is harder to make a living doing it.
Right.
And the thing with Sugary Cereals, I agreed 100% with putting the stuff online, because I think, as Egon said in the first Ghostbusters movie, Prince is dead. And Harold Ramis is white right back in 1984, and here we are. We're going towards the internet. I think it's the wave of the future. People are reading more PDFs, and you know, they're going more of a quick fix. Look at comic strips like PvP and Arcade. They have huge conventions now for Penny Arcade. This is web comics that guys do.
Right, these guys have a comic, and now they have their own convention. Their own convention.
Yeah.
What Marvel comic has its own freaking convention?
It doesn't happen, exactly right. And there's a whole different marketplace that is very much like looking at art supplies, and you look at like a Joe Kubert art book on how to draw, and you see like these nibs and quill pens to ink with, and it's like, we don't use that anymore. We're the digital age. We're the computer. We're doing this stuff on the computer. It's all computer-based. It's much more modern. Mm-hmm. And comics is always the last thing to go kicking and screaming into any kind of change. And I think in terms of my major idea was really to do stuff for kids. I mean, that was my major push because it just, in my mind, it wasn't everything I've been trying to get DC to do for the last 5 years has been like this preaching to the wind because guys would agree with me, but it's never going to get passed.
Mm-hmm.
And I was giving them ideas on how to make the books interactive. I still have the list. All the cool stuff I grew up with, like the old giant-sized treasury. Remember the dioramas in the back of them? And like,
oh, yeah.
First Micronauts comics when they had the secret codes hidden in the backgrounds and stuff. And, I mean, there's so much cool stuff that we can inject into comics that they just don't bother to do it. And it's a shame because I think with kids, that is the marketplace. With the comic industry right now, there are no new readers. This industry, and I know you've heard me preach this before, but there are everyone between 27 and 40 is who they're selling to. That is
right.
Their weekly books. Now, what happens when you have a young guy who gets married, buys a house, has a mortgage, especially now with the foreclosures going on, and then he has a kid. He's dropping 200 books when he's single in college a month, and now he's down to 100. Now he's down to $20 once he has a house and a wife and two kids. And there's only so much money to go around, and they're not bringing in any new readers in terms
mm-hmm.
of kids. And the product is such that when one of my fellow DC artists gets their comp box, their kid goes, "Oh, can I see the Batman comic?" And he had looked at it, and he said, "No." Get a Batman comic because it's the All-Star thing, which is, you know, completely garbage.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, you can't have Hero's Curse. I mean, it's, you know, you have the really whacked out archetype of heroes, the way they're written by Frank Miller. You know, like I say, you know, there's certain things I don't like to see. I don't like to see the heroes smoke. I don't want to see them curse.
Mm-hmm.
There's certain heroic traits that do subliminally get into kids' minds. When they see Peter Parker and all the problems he has in life, and he gets by without doing drugs, without drinking, without smoking, and he still putters on like he's doing his thing, I think that subliminally goes into kids' heads.
No, you're absolutely right. And we pick up on that no matter how little we think our brain is working when we're actually reading the books. Like, I think of, do you remember the issue, I've talked about this in other places, and I don't think I've talked about this with you yet. The issue, it was Spider-Man Annual number 20, it was from the 80s, and he fights the Iron Man of 2020.
Yep, I remember.
It's Tony Stark's son. And it was like this big debacle where there's like Arno Stark went into the past to stop this kid who's going to grow up to be a terrorist from doing this terrible thing in the future. And Spidey doesn't know anything about that conflict. All he knows is that there's a kid in danger and Iron Man seems to be attacking him. And at one point during the fight, this kid gets hurt really bad. And when that happens, Spider-Man just unloads on Iron Man and he starts beating him so hard that his armor actually gets blasted off of his body. And when Spider-Man sees that there's nothing left to protect this guy, he stops. Why? Because a hero doesn't kill. He doesn't beat a guy that far down. He beats him till he's disarmed, and that's it. And even then, the glory of that scene is that Spidey points at him and he says, "I used to respect you, admire you almost." And then he says, "And you, and you can tell he's trying to cook up a big insult, but he's Spider-Man, so he can't. So he says, "You creep." That's the best he could do because he's Peter Parker. He can't think of a clever thing to say. Otherwise, he's not Peter Parker anymore.
And you go back at that point in time, and now you look at Spider-Man now with this next day, whatever the day after or whatever they're doing now, and you have a feeling, you know, Aunt May is going to die or what have you in the comic, and he'll go back and kill the Kingpin if you've been following it because he threatened the Kingpin. If anything happens to my family, I'm going to kill you. Completely out of tempo for this thing that is going on now. It is really written much more adult.
Yeah.
In terms of concepts and themes now, where I just don't think kids could pick it up and grasp it because it's not the character I grew up with. He's written much more adult and realistic. Even Ultimate Spider-Man, you read there and you have the cartoon cursing language, you know, with the squiggles and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, he'll curse in that. To a certain extent, I think, you know, kids don't need to see that, not with their heroes.
Right. No, and I think that there are actual rules that you can't deviate from with certain characters. There's, like, parameters they have to operate in order to remain true to what they were in the first place. Like, I remember back just before Infinite Crisis, there was an issue of Superman that I read where he was hallucinating that all of his worst enemies were killing Lois Lane over and over again. And it had something to do with Max Lord controlling his mind. Max Lord was feeding him these images. And in every situation where Lois got killed, now again, it was just in his mind, but for all intents and purposes, Superman thought this was real. He went on a murderous rampage, and he would grab onto Doomsday and say, "I'll kill you, I'll kill you." And I got really upset about this. As, you know, no matter what, Superman does not murder. He does not kill, no matter what. Otherwise, he's not Superman anymore. And then a friend of mine and I got into an argument about it, and he said, "Well, what if his wife getting killed? You know, if your wife got killed, you'd want to murder. I'm not Superman. Superman cannot murder. Otherwise, you violated something that critical about that character." So I think that there's roads that you don't necessarily need to go down. Make a new character if you want to do that with him. You don't need to take Spider-Man and have him curse or have him, you know, do things that are more like what you would do, because that's not what a hero is, at least to me.
Exactly right, yeah. I think that the major part of that is they're iconic characters, but they want to take them and make them so realistic in today's world. I mean, there's no fun in just being – if you read, like, Marvel Adventures Spider-Man or Fantastic – or The Avengers that Jeff Parker – because he had written the first year of Marvel Adventures FF, and he's such a fun writer. But you read the first two issues of the Avengers Marvel Adventures series, and I read issue 1 and 2 right after there. They were so much fun. You didn't
really
know what the team was. They were just the iconic Marvel characters all thrown together, and they just worked. And who would have thought the Hulk would have had the best lines out of it? It's a gag. I mean, just the plausibility of in issue 9, when they all got turned into these little MODOK characters, and they all get blown up, and they don't think of the logic where, well, how does Wolverine get his head that way when he has an adamantium skull?
Right.
There is no, it just is. And, you know, a lot of people, even with the movies, we have to make them so realistic that I think the major part of that is, I mean, look at the beauty of the Adam West Batman, whether guys liked that show or they thought it was campy and destructive to the character, it was so much fun that you just lend yourself over to that universe, because the people there on the show, they took it seriously in terms of, you know, when Batman's running through the city, they were like, what are these guys running around, you know? They were like, well, it's Batman and Robin, he's off to save the day, you know, and they took it very seriously. And if you give yourself over into that universe, then it's infinitely fun. And a lot of people today, they don't want that. They want everything etched in stone. It's like the Star Trek crowd. You know, we come up with the Enterprise, and now somebody's trying to figure out how to make the engines actually work. Like, I don't need the, you know, was it Dave Brown or Dan Brown in the 80s used to do the Marvel cutaways, and he used to do, like, the web shooter in the Marvel Universe book and explain how the mechanical Spider-Man web shooter, how it actually worked. And
there's a fun aspect to that. I mean, that's something when you're a little kid you always wonder about. Like, why are Spider-Man's eyes white? How can he see through those lenses? And when I saw the Steve Ditko cutaway of how the costume works, I was like, oh, that's fascinating. But, you know, it's always – for me, it was always a sideline issue. It was never – as long as it didn't get in the way of the story.
Right.
Then the only Marvel Adventures books I've been reading with any kind of regularity are the Power Pack books. And those are a lot of fun to read. And they're just
Spider-Man, I love. I read everything. I tell you, when I did the Talk to Comic Geek Speak, and I still talk to the guys at every show, and I do the 300 episode coming up. Every time I told them, I said, you know, when it started with Civil War, Marvel, right before then, when Straczynski did the whole Gwen Stacy storyline.
Oh, man,
That was just like a debacle. And then it started with DC with Identity Crisis or whatever have you. And it just felt like after all these years, Marvel and DC had, like, pushed me out the door.
Yeah.
Just as a reader. And I just felt like, okay, now what? Well, there's Independence, which I'm going to pick up and read. But now it's like I just kind of pick and choose. I certainly don't buy the books I used to buy before. You know, I read Daredevil. I loved the Marvel Adventures. The Mary Jane comic is brilliant. I love this. Spider-Man loves Mary Jane. That is the most – that's like the book guys will read but say they don't. And it's a great book. It's a solid production.
Yeah.
And from top to bottom, and it has a WB kind of TV show quality to it. And it's just a fun read.
Yeah, it's like watching Gilmore Girls. No, I wholeheartedly agree with that. And the funny thing is I think we're talking about characters that are elastic enough that you can tell adult stories about them as well as all-ages stories about them. And it's just funny that it's going all one way, and it doesn't seem like that the other way is being honored enough. I mean, you've got Marvel Adventures, but, you know, and then you got like the Giant DC stuff or Teen Titans Go, whatever you want to call that line of DC stuff. But it just doesn't seem like it's quite balanced. And there's certainly no coverage of both ends, equal coverage for both ends in like the media. You know, it's like Captain America died, so that's a sensational story. Let's talk about that. Well, that's not your entry book for a kid.
Exactly right. And the funny thing is Graham Nolan, who used to draw Batman in the 90s, he just recently got back in a comic strip after drawing the Phantom in the newspaper for many years. And he has an old school style, so it's really hard for him to get new work. But he wound up, he's doing Marvel Adventures Iron Man right now. So it looks like a 70s throwback book. But when
he
tried talking about the book, it's like, well, yeah, I'm doing Marvel Adventures Iron Man, you know, it's like the kids thing. And you know, it's like it doesn't matter. It's like somehow it's like the shame that you're doing this.
Wow.
And it's the perception out there in the public. It's like, well, I'm doing Marvel. If I was going to draw Spider-Man, I mean, definitely I would want to draw Marvel Adventures Spider-Man.
Oh, hands down, absolutely. Yeah, that would be the one that I would want to do. I would be, as much as, you know, every artist wants to do that one-issue Spider-Man, if I had to do one where there was all that dark stuff happening, I don't think I'd be comfortable drawing it. So
yeah,
I can't imagine.
I would never have done the other storyline when it got his eye plucked out and then died and all that. I mean, I just would have walked off the book if I saw that script come and said, you know, I'm out. this isn't what I've, you know, planned on. And then the whole Iron Spidey with a different thing and Civil War. And I'm like, you know,
yeah.
I don't know. It's just not what I thought it was going to be. And ultimately, when I do the Alfie thing, I mean, it's basically the storyline that I want, and it's basically more personal because it's based on real events and real locales, and it's just more cute. Working in different licensing like I have for all these years, it's just, you work on this stuff for kids for so long, it just gets ingrained in your head that you want everything to have like a cutesy look because you're looking at it from the marketing standpoint. Now I know why Disney does these things. Now I know why Pixar draws this way. Now I know why they do certain little nuances of stuff that I can pick out. And it's like some comic book guys who do just comics don't want to do that. I've told guys who have their own properties, I said, look, if you did this, this, and this, make it dumb it down just a little bit, and, you know, and it would probably move. And I said, oh, I don't want to do that. You know, they're writing for an older crowd.
Well, yeah. But I also think it's important to recognize the fact that doing the kind of stuff that you're doing, like you were just saying, that now you understand why Pixar and Disney does these things. That just goes to show that there is a craft and an intentionality behind doing the work that appeals to all ages or to children. There's some hard and fast rules, and there are some things that work better than other things. So given that, that means that there is a skill set involved in making these comics, and it's something that we should really hesitate to put down. You know, when people say, "Oh, this is just for kids," well, no. It's, you say, "Oh, this is for kids." And it's, to me, it's just as intentional and as valid and as thoughtful in the act of creation as anything that's made for adults, in my opinion. Maybe it's not as gut-wrenching. Maybe it's not the, you know, Elizabeth Taylor movie where everybody's crying and throwing stuff at each other and swearing.
Right.
But it is, there is just as much craft and there's just as much thought put into every decision that's made. And I've, you know, you look at the preview pages on the Sugary Cereal site, and Alfie is absolutely adorable. And I don't think there's anybody who would disagree with that. And there's a reason.
The thing I planned for was a lot because I'm hitting for a girl market. I mean, I've had mothers who've looked at it and go, oh, they're dog lovers. Like Gringo was. He was a huge dog lover. If you look at his stuff, his corporate work, you go to his blog when he was drawing pictures, it was all furry animals and battle suits and the kind of Lord of the Rings Dactylos thing he was doing. And that was where his heart was. And that was his best stuff, was in the morning. And then he'd have to put it down and go back to work on, you know.
Yeah.
Stuff.
And Telos was absolutely gorgeous. It was just a gorgeous, gorgeous series.
And the problem is you couldn't make a living doing it because fantasy is a hard market to crack in this comic book field, you know?
Right.
Either the long underwear crowd or, the long underwear crowd, or you're going to have a thing like Terry Moore who does Strangers in Paradise, or, you know, unless you do something like Bone, you know, with Jeff Smith. It's a cartoon, and then he winds up taking it to Scholastic, and then it gets worldwide, you know?
Well, I think that we stand on the cusp of a new time where there are children today are growing up with the computer. They're used to it. It's not like us where, you know, we remember it in our youth, but it didn't become part of our daily lives until recently. These kids are growing up and the computer's just there for them all the time, and it's providing them with all their entertainment all the time. And that's one of the gambles I'm betting on with things like sugary cereals is give them the content on the computer. They'll be perfectly comfortable reading it. But if you're a parent and you're not as comfortable reading the content on the computer, well, hey, here's the print version. Or you don't want to read it online, that's cool. Download the PDF. Read it whenever you feel like.
One of the sad things is with it that you don't even have Saturday morning cartoons anymore.
I know.
They don't even have that experience of getting up at 6 in the morning and eating a big bowl of cereal and watching cartoons from 6 till 12.
Yeah. The Saturday live action special would come on hosted by Captain Kangaroo, you know, and then you knew it was time to go outside.
Yeah. But you used to have the previews and stuff like the Friday night used to have like, you know, celebrities going over the new cartoons that are going to air tomorrow.
Yeah.
And growing up, man, I used to watch Dukes of Hazzard on Friday night on TV. And then Saturday morning you had the Dukes cartoon.
Yeah, you did.
Spider-Man for a little while. And then you had the Spider-Man and the Hulk, and that just, you know, pushed it forward. I knew the new Spider-Man cartoon, which is coming out soon, looks really cool. It kind of looks like a throwback to the 60s thing.
Huh.
In terms of the style, the way it's going to be done through Sony. But it looks like it's going to be a real fun thing, not like the MTV CGI thing. This is still going to be 2D.
Ah, cool.
So it's going to be, it looks really pretty enticing. I'm looking really forward to that. And hopefully we'll have fun stories where, you know, even the most implausible things are allowed to happen and just happen. I don't mind plot sometimes. I don't need everything filled out.
No. And that was part of the magic of 60s Marvel, was when you had Jack Kirby on board, nothing was off the table. And you could have characters like MODOK show up, and it's like, you just take it for granted. Oh, he's a big bad guy.
When I see the movie Ocean's 13, and the person I went with is like, oh, this couldn't happen. It's like, how did they get that giant drill underneath the ground, you know, to set up the earthquake and all that? And I'm sitting there going, Danny Ocean, he's cool, man. He can make things happen.
I watched the Superman Returns, which it was kind of but for me anyway, I didn't really get that big of a kick out of it. But I'll tell you the one part I really loved was the part when they pull out that gigantic chain gun. There's just these guys, these burglars on top of a building with a gigantic chain gun blowing up cop cars left and right.
How'd they get up there?
Yeah, how'd they get up there? It doesn't matter. It just looks amazing. And you can't wait to see that thing turn on Superman. That's all you need. There's that 10-year-old, that 8-year-old sensibility about story that sometimes people forget about, where you don't criticize everything. You walk in with a trusting mind that as long as it's entertaining, it's okay.
I think, it all starts when you're young. You start to pick up on stuff. A lot of kids now, because they don't read comics, a lot of my storytelling, I think, came from reading comics and watching cartoons and old movies. And a lot of kids I see now that I teach, you know, for a drawing for animation course, they just don't have these abilities now. I mean, even with the little kids, when I do cartooning classes with kids, they don't grasp they come up with something out of their own head. It's so visual and everything is literally given to them, where if you give them a South Park thing of the four characters, it's how you want to create your own South Park character. It's always a hybrid of these characters. It's so hard for these kids to think outside the box and just say, you know, come up with a clown or something and out of their own head. And if they really have a hard time doing that.
Yeah. And I'm finding too, that at least in the schools I taught at, there wasn't much art in the curriculum. So you had kids who were just absolutely terrified to draw. They wanted to get it right. And I was trying to emphasize to these poor kids, like, no, look, there's no right. There's no wrong. It's what you want. And just do your best to put it on the paper. And you try to get these kids to understand this notion of, you're going to get better. Just keep on plugging away at it. You're going to get better. But when you're in a school systems where there's not much art and you're dealing with, you know, trying to make standardized test scores higher, you got a lot of situations where these kids are in, like, right and wrong situations. So they're not as eager to play. You know, and I think that's what's really critical to a young artist is doing things in a spirit of play.
That's right.
And then you will.
A lot of that stuff in terms of leadership, I guess, in terms of the teachers. I mean, if a teacher finds a kid who does have some kind of artistic ability, do they push them enough in that thing, and in terms of getting better, or at least expand their mind?
I found that there were a few. There was a handful of really exceptional teachers that I worked with who, they approached the whole notion of this comic artist coming into their classroom to teach comics. They kind of had a raised eyebrow about it at first, but then you could see them really plugging in and starting to notice the kids who had a rich visual vocabulary where they had written that kid off before as someone who was maybe a slow learner. You know, he wasn't very good at his reading. Well, you know, through the comics, this kid could prove that he had a rich understanding of story. He just had a much more of a visual sense than a verbal sense.
Yep.
And when I was there to point it out to the teacher, like, look at what this kid is expressing just with lines. See what this kid's doing. You could see the light bulbs turn on for a couple of these teachers. The cool thing was in the project that I was involved with, the Literacy Arts Comic Book Project, is the teachers actually designed lessons that used comics to help teach. That was the end of the project, was them designing their own lessons. So, like, they're using comics to teach civics class. They're using comics to teach, you know, folk tales and things like that. So that was awesome.
Maybe in the old days of Classics Illustrated, you know, you don't see much of them either now with the terms of...
No, you're right.
You have Harry Potter.
You're right, and...
But, you know, kids will pick that up and read 700 pages like it's nothing. They'll devour it. So what is it
which
about
just goes
that?
To show, if you make... Well, you got a compelling, you know, premise and characters, and as long as you've got that, the kids will sign on and they'll put in the time to read it. You know, I don't know about you, but when I was a little kid, I was not even remotely interested in reading Dickens, but that was on the docket, you know, they wanted us to read Dickens. So later on, I developed an appreciation for it, but when you're 13, you don't care. You don't want to read Great Expectations. That's nothing to do with your life. Whereas Harry Potter is kind of like, it very much like superheroes are for us. You know, it's like this kind of like this epic stage where your concerns are projected onto this larger thing, right? Because they're all teenagers. They're all experiencing teen problems. There's a bully in the class, and you kind of got feelings for this girl, but you don't know how to express it. And by the way, there's a giant coming. You got to go zap him.
Right. I think there's an appeal.
That's essentially what Spider-Man.
Characters like Captain Underpants. I mean, even with a chapter book. I mean, if you read those as an adult, it's the same thing every book. And stuff happens literally by chapter 5. This is what's going to happen, and it's broken down the same way. It's just insert names here, type of writing, and yet they double. And it catches. They look at that and they go, "Oh, you know, this is something I can grasp a hold of." You don't see this kind of kids' books in terms of like the superhero stuff. I mean, you see that for kind of the Marvel, but they're always based on the movies. They're not like singular adventures of Spider-Man. That's like, because then if they go and pick up the other actual comics of Spider-Man, they don't correspond with what they've just read. You know, how many library talks have I done where we'll sit there looking at kids, and these kids don't know Peter Parker and Mary Jane have been married for like 20 years.
Yeah.
Clark Kent and Super Lois Lane, I mean, they don't have a kid, you know, like the movie, you know, they'll say, hey, where's the kid? You know, well, they don't have that in the comic books, but, you know, they've been married, though, for a long time, and you know, they don't grasp certain things the way it's done now. That's why a lot of the source material is changed style. I mean, especially Marvel right now, they just pick and choose what they want to do. And I think that was one of the things I wanted to do, was set a specific consistency across the board in terms of the universe for Alfie. And it would be, I felt with everything in mind, it was going to be aimed for the younger readers. It's going to be aimed for girls as well, the cute factor. With all supporting characters. I think the bonus thing was that it's all based on reality, so you can actually walk around the block from the first story arc. I mean, you can literally see the houses as you walk. It's really right there. You don't have to make a Benji movie. You can make a live action.
Yeah.
See all the...
You can see that in the preview pages, that you, like the sketches you're working out where you're taking pictures from Alfie's vantage point to make sure that you're delineating the world that he would see.
Well, I went back and I redrew
the
page because the street that I had him running down dry rotted out and they took the tree out. I went back and redrew page. Yeah, to put him on the other side of the street because I needed the tree. That's where the squirrels are. And I said, oh, well, there's no more tree there. It doesn't match what I drew. So I went back and had to change it just for the aesthetic of it, you know, which is kind of funny, though. But the cute factor is and doing stuff with dogs. It's more, it's easier, right? This is stuff I got from Alfie, was stuff that he was doing when he was a baby. Now he's like 4.5 years old. And there's the quirky stuff that you just pick up and you know, and it's like what they tell you, you know, always write what you know. And I just thought it was kind of appealing, and people love dogs, especially now with the Michael Vick situation and how people feel about their dogs and such. And I said, well, that's a cool market to be in. I think even if it's written for a younger crowd, I think even a serious comic guy would be at the show, they would just poo-poo the whole thing and say, you know, this is lame. You know, what are you doing this for? You know.
Well, but then I think you can show them, you know, all the families that are reading it, and I think that's where the last laugh is. I mean, Scott Kurtz once said, this was a long time ago. I think it was on like the Blank Label Comics podcast. He said that he's talking about when he introduced this cat character into PvP,
yep.
And he said that once he introduced that cat character, he finally understood why people love Garfield so much, because if you have the cat do anything, you get 100 emails of people saying, that's just like my cat.
Right.
So if you're a pet owner, you're going to identify with the pet, because of course you love your pet so much, and you're going to map what you love about your pet onto this other pet character. And if Alfie does anything remotely like what somebody else's dog did, then of course they're going to suddenly just completely invest themselves in that character.
Yeah, and I think it's a certain amount of the cute factor with the Disney thing, but it harkens back to the look and the feel is back to the old Dell and Disney comics of the 50s when they were everywhere. And, you know, you used to see that stamp on the back of, like, the old Dell comics. And say, you know, these comics, we guarantee these comics are wholesome and this and that and the other thing. And, you know, you knew it was safe for a kid. And there were a ton of Disney properties and, you know, stuff with dogs and animals, and of course all the Hanna-Barbera stuff, and I think there's certainly none of that today, because a lot of the characters now, you don't see any of the Flintstones or Jetsons. I think that was kind of played out, but even Yogi Bear and stuff, unless kids have Boomerang, they're not going to see these classic characters, because everything has been pretty much done before. I mean, when people look at Alfie, they can go, oh, it kind of looks like Lady and the Tramp or something of that nature from the style of it, and it's like, well, I mean, you know, Alfie was the hardest thing I ever drew. I mean, I've designed Scooby-Doo villains in like 2 drawings, and Alfie takes 50, literally 50 drawings to get him to where I wanted him to look like and capture the spirit of, and this is a dog that's right in front of me in real life.
and a dog that you spend every day with. So, I mean, it seems like, but that just goes to show how invested you are in this project. Because you are being that fastidious.
Spawned off of him, and then all of a sudden, now you're drawing the squirrels, and now you're trying to do a squirrel that looks different. Because you don't want to draw. Everyone draws squirrels like a Preston Blair out of the drawing books, Preston Blair squirrel. And I draw a different tail based on how they actually how I think they look instead of this big puffy tail, and then designing these other characters. Like the rabbits, and especially like Jersey, where it comes from, and the backstory on all these animals, and I think that's really the fun part, cause especially when you're dealing with bunnies and stuff. How many different ways are there to draw bunnies, especially in a commercial style, without going too stylistic?
Right.
So I think younger readers, they go for that softer, slightly more detailed look in terms of their eyes and how they perceive stuff to be. They wouldn't get, you know, there's certain, like Courage the Cowardly Dog is a little pink lima bean. And how many people would look at that and go, well, what is that? Well, it's a dog. You know, it's like,
right.
He's pink. And he's like, well, he kind of looks like a dog from the nose, but you wouldn't know the way he's built, and he kind of hops around on his legs. I mean, mine's pretty much, you know, kind of based on all dogs go to heaven type of thing, where it's based on more reality, but the quirk of the other characters as well. So
The style looks much more classic. And to that, I really would like to take my hat off to you for that, because it seems like these days with the popularity of Cartoon Network stuff, and don't get me wrong, I love Cartoon Network stuff. Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends is one of my favorite cartoons ever.
Yeah.
But it does seem like the onset of all the Tartakovsky and McCracken cartoons meant that everybody was now doing these very graphically stylized characters.
Yeah, they're called the hard-edged characters.
Yeah.
Thick outline.
And it's refreshing to see something that's a little bit more classic once again. And you're right, it does evoke that whole kind of like Donald Duck comics kind of look to it, the 1950s.
The problem is right now, this is the last year for Bruce Timm's contract at Warner Brothers, and You know, they're done with him. They're done with his style. I mean, it's been aped enough where, you know, he's done. I don't know what he's going to do afterwards, but they're done with him and his style. They don't want to use it anymore, which is why they got Jeff Masuda to come in and do the new Batman designs.
Oh, wow.
And he's just outdated. So if he goes to comics, they don't want that look anymore. And it's
kind of
a shame. It's a classic kind of throwback look to the old Fleischer cartoons, but it just goes to show that I guess everything comes full circle, though. But my intent was just looking at Alfie and just doing these drawings over. It just kind of evolved where it looks kind of like a Disney thing, but everything was based on the eyes and capturing his, you know, livelihood. And people who have seen Alfie and stuff, and you know, if it comes to a point where I take him to conventions with me or something like that.
Well, how cool would that be?
And it would be kind of cool, but my friends and stuff, they look at it and they go, oh, man, you nailed it. So they just look at the drawings and some of the other poses and stuff, and they go, oh, man, that's the dog, you know. And that's kind of cool. But it's much more fulfilling creatively where there's no changes. There's no – I edit my own stuff, but I have, you know, people who do look at it at DC and stuff who are helping me out with it. And they actually give me advice on certain – story points and stuff like that, but it's basically I'm just trying to keep it as much fun as I can and just have it more of the comics I grew up with, especially for younger readers. I know a lot of comic guys aren't going to dig what I'm doing because it's more for kids and it's more for the littler kid, like 2 to 5 year old, you know, but that's another whole market, you know, and that's,
yeah,
you know, guys look at Smurfs and they go, oh, this is lame, but, you know, Smurfs have been around for 40 years.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I mean, that's the fact of the matter is in the long run, while I'd love to have those guys reading our stuff, they're ultimately not really necessarily our audience. The guy who rolls his eyes at something that's okay for kids too is not going to like anything at Sugary Cereals anyway. So that's fine; they can do that. But you know, hopefully, we'll be able to reach out to a bunch of
people. You can get it into the kids and advertise the website and into schools and get kids wanting to read and maybe sign up and create fan clubs and you know, to build it up as a, you know, some kind of learning tools or something. You know, if Marvel and DC are slipping the thing, you know. Put the equalizers in, you know, in some kind of school capacity, you know, and teaching math or something of that nature. I think it'll.
Well, that's something I wanted to kind of touch on just briefly because you do teach, and that this is something where I'm getting into this in the last couple of years as well, teaching art and comics in libraries and schools and places. And one of the things I think is really a responsibility of every comic artist. And I'm not just saying this just because I'm doing it. This was something I felt very strongly before I got into the teaching thing. And it was largely what made me get into the teaching thing is we're at a point where, as you said, mainstream comics is a very insular industry. And they're pretty much marketing to a very small group of people, and they're content with that. Okay, that's fine. But outside of that, there's this huge interest in the comics art form in the form of manga, in the form of, you know, books like I was saying before, Gene Yang's American-Born Chinese winning, you know, prestigious book awards, and all these people in libraries that I talk to are just, they're dying to know more about this comic stuff that the kids are so interested in. You sign up for you start a comics class at a library, and you get, you know, 20, 30 young girls signed up for it. There's this huge amount of interest in comics, and the big two, the big four, whatever you want to call them, they're not stepping up to the plate as much as they could to really put on a good face.
Yep.
And make sure people really understand that this art form, this form of entertainment is for everybody. So it's up to us. It's up to guys like you and me to go out there and really promote. And by doing that, we're helping our art form, but we're also promoting ourselves. And that's an important thing that I think every artist should be doing in some form or another. And that helps get their work into schools. That helps get their work into libraries. I did a class at the Chelsea Public Library here in Michigan. And you know, part of my compensation for doing the 6-week course was they'd put some of my books in their collection, you know, so that's where you're going to get a lot of walk-by readers. You know, there's kids already in the comics section. They see this book called The Front. They're like, what's this all about? And then they start reading it. They're not going to find out about it at the comic store because they're not going there.
True. And people don't know about it. I'm getting like an alumni award for the college I had gone to for 1 year to learn my computer skills, and they're giving me like a Rising Star Award for the presentation of the screens. I have a full screen for Alfie, and that I'm going to show, as well as, you know, the sugary cereal's address for people. So how many people in that room, you know, advertise, you know, get
right.
people to draw them to the thing, you know, and it's you got to build people through that way, through normal media. As soon as I get cranking, I'm calling up all the papers and everything else around here. I'm going to
mm-hmm.
get me to get me through the door, you know, and then say, hey, look at this over here, you know.
Right.
And, but I think it's going to be a huge thing in terms of, because most people don't realize, and I gave a little stack down the street of comics to this little girl who's six, and her mother looked at him, and she goes, oh, comics, you know, Cartoon Network, and, oh, Archie's, they still make these? She just didn't have any clue. She hadn't seen them, doesn't know what a comic book store is, has no clue, and her daughter just watches cartoons and doesn't know comics exist.
Right.
And she's, you know, 6 years old now, and, you know, it's just a real shame that these kids don't grow up with Spider-Man. I used to run around in one of these plastic Spider-Man costumes with the old Spider-Man web shooter, blue web shooter on my arm. You know,
oh, wow.
You know, with a string and the dart and all that stuff, and playing with Amigo dolls and all that. And, you know, there's so much more product, and it was all aimed for me, in a sense. It felt like that. And when you read the Spidey Super stories, it was able to, you felt like you were part of something somehow. And then you kind of graduated on into the other comics.
And right.
You deemed the normal comics. But even then, they were all ages. And I think that's just where it has to go in terms of making it accessible. Because, I mean, I've been in comic stores. A parent will bring back a copy of Spawn because the word damn was used in it.
Mm-hmm.
Who deems that as being a curse word or, you know, unacceptable? Maybe down south in the Bible Belt, or, you know, how kids are raised where, you know, certain comics are, you know, like you say, you can't give out comics for Halloween or whatever, or give them away. And it's like Mike Manley used to do that all the time. He used to give comics away. All of a sudden, then he started having to go flip and throw them, and he's it got to be too much of a bother, so he just stopped giving them out.
Wow.
You have two boxes of comics, and you'd have to stop and, like, you got to spend, like, a whole day going through the comics and flipping through to make sure every little panel, that like, there's not something, you know, snuck in there that shouldn't be there, or, you know, even language or something. Make sure there's not a Vertigo book in there or something, you know?
No, yeah, I hear you. So, well, we should probably wrap this up. We've been going at it for quite a while, but I'd love to have you on again in another episode.
All right.
And maybe we can talk a little bit more about your teaching next time. Talk
yeah,
about some of the class
that
you do.
Yeah, I started it, actually. So at the Bellower College of Art and Design, Mike Manley kind of got me the job because he couldn't do it. And I'm teaching drawing college-age kids. So that's another whole adventure from, you know, their
oh, wow.
drawing ability, which is kind of poor at that stage, where I think they should be.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually have to teach an 8 to 11-year-old for level to college kids in terms of art. Which is something we could talk about.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's pretty sad. And they want to be, you know,
well, that'll be offensive.
Animation and comics and all this stuff. And, you know, I was much further along. I'm not saying I was great at that time, but I understood so much more that these kids are just not grasping.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're dealing with personalities, very strong personalities at that point too. Where and I'm dealing with you know, some 17-year-olds. You'll get this something a little bit of like a I just want to do it mentality. You try to teach them process, try to teach them, you know, like a starting point and how you got to flesh it out slowly. And they just like, look, I just want to.
I understand exactly what you're talking about. And the thing is, how many of these kids are lucky to have, I'm going to toot my own horn, but how lucky to have me and have Mike Manley, who's actually working right now doing storyboards and design for a cartoon, for Cartoon Network that'll be premiering
mm-hmm.
in April. He's actually working
mm-hmm.
on something that they aspire to do. And this is a guy, and these kids just look the other way. I mean, how cool would it have been to have, like, go to school and have, like, John Romita, you know, teaching there at a class. You know, when I'm reading a Spider-Man, I would have been all over him. I would have been talking to him after class and all this kind of cool stuff. And these kids, as soon as the bell
yeah.
rings, they're out the door and gone.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Thing, you know?
Yeah, I totally know what you mean. But at the same time, it totally sounds like we're old men going, kids today.
Well, it's true to a certain extent, but the little ones, you don't want them to get jaded, but these younger kids who are in college, and they say, oh, they want to do this, and they don't know what it entails of being a freelancer, and there are a lot of guys I know,
yeah.
I mean, there are guys who walk, and they all sit and they laugh, oh, you drew strawberry shortcake, ah, you know, and I'll tell them, I said, you guys couldn't handle a day of strawberry shortcake. I finished the three projects because two guys walked off of their project. They couldn't handle it. And they walked off, and I had to finish their gig for them. And it was like, sometimes you got to have jobs going in at the same time, and it's like, it's hard, man.
There's a slogan for you. You're not man enough for strawberry shortcake.
Hey, I tell you, man. I tell kids, man. She's a man. she will chew you up and spit you out. And especially if you don't know Adobe Illustrator, when it's all done in that program, and it's like, man, it is brutal. I mean, it's fun to see it's all done, but the actual work that goes into it, and it's like, oh. Like I said, the only bad part is corporate. When you walk into Target and you see the thing you created for something, and it's like it's up on a pair of pajamas, and you're like, oh, because you don't own it. Like, oh, if I had a nickel, you know.
Yeah. Well, if you do get that article printed in Draw Magazine, I hope you'll let us know, because I'll be champing at the bit to read it.
Yeah, I'm going to have to try to get to that later this fall and to get that going, because I got so many things going on at once with the projects, and then trying to with How and Al, especially because I got to go back down. We are doing a drawing section for How and Al, which I'm going down to shoot next week after the Baltimore Comic Con.
Oh, awesome.
I wanted to tell you about the Baltimore Comic Con. This year, they're going to have a whole kids pavilion, like dead center of this thing. And it's going to be the comic book designer thing. John Gallagher does Buzz Boy, which is his creation, and Rich Faber. We have Steve Connolly. He's going to be there. I have myself. We have Scott.
Oh, wow.
Crypto. We're going to have a whole diner setting, like in the center, where there's going to be like diner chairs where kids can sit. We're going to be around the outside of the thing drawing for kids. We're going to have a whole coloring section for kids with like coloring book pages that kids can color there. We're going to have like 150 Boy Scouts. They're going to come in for this thing to push Kids Love Comics. That's John's logo, Kids Love Comics. And it's going to be a major focal point because Mark Nathan, who runs it, is really trying to push, you know, trying to get more family-oriented things. Let me tell you a little side thing. I mean, how bad is it where they want to get more family-oriented stuff into these shows where the guys who run the Big Apple Con in New York City, I was sitting at Wizard Philly, and they came over to me, and they gave, I have your card. I said, we want you to come up to, you know, to the Big Apple shows. They said, we have to get more family-friendly stuff up there. I said, we'll give you a spot.
Wow.
We'll hook you up. Oh, we really want you to come. Because they already had a spot where they would put me in everything. And what does that say about the industry when they're looking, these people who run these shows are trying to get more family-oriented stuff in there? The single mom and the kids walking around between me and Scott, who was sitting next to me because he was doing crypto. And all these little kids are reaching over the table, grabbing his crypto comics and stuff. And it's like, and Scott thought, you know, he's like, oh, man, what kind of job did you get me? I said, no, man, trust me, man. This is where it's at. And he was right. I told him, I said, this is where it's going, man. We had more younger kids, and the people would come by, oh, so here we go, something for you. And they would look at their kid, you know, and it was all kid-friendly stuff, and it was like Scooby and Winnie the Pooh and Mickey Mouse stuff that I had, and they could just say, oh, okay, this is all safe, you know, as long as they don't put you next to somebody who does, like, goth stuff or...
That happened to me at Motor City. We were two tables down from a guy who took photographs of women in very non-kid-friendly outfits. And, you know, it's like me and then Dan Mishkin pushing his Actionopolis book. You know, it was a kid-friendly book, and then this goth booth. It's always nice when you see that.
I remember at the Wizard Philly this year, they had the guy who does Max Ham, who does private detective thing, which is like a little golden book style. And he was sitting right next to, like, a porn star. It wasn't Philly.
Yay.
And it was like people would just pass the table by. And he was like, I can't believe this. You're killing my viewership. Because people come over and they see little pasteovers on photos. And it was like on her side.
Yeah.
And it just completely destroyed his traffic, where he had a pure all-ages fun book called Max Ham. And Fairy Tale Detective. It was just kind of killed it for him. But...
I've heard of that, actually. Well, that's awesome that at Baltimore they're going to actually have a kids or an all-ages pavilion.
It's going to be really cool. I think it's going to be a really big event, I think, this year in terms of really pushing it. We're going to have Andy Runton, who does Owly right across from us. And, you know, he does a pure kids book with Owly, and he has little stuff plushies, that kind of cool stuff. And he's really trying to push to get more kid-friendly stuff in there for, and then on Sunday too, he lets kids in for free too, so they don't have to pay him. That's why I always do Baltimore and kind of Wizard Philly because they're the thing for me personally.
When is the Baltimore show?
It's actually this weekend, the 8th and 9th.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll put this one. I might put this one up then next on the site. This podcast. So that way, we can let people know if they're in the area to go see at the Baltimore show.
Yeah, because I'll have the preview books too. They're for the sugary cereals as well on my table for people to page through and see and advertise it as well. So I think it's going to be
awesome.
It's going to be big, I think, once it gets going. You know, this time. Next year, maybe start doing some more sugary cereals, type of a table, or getting, you know, some kind of a thing going where you have like the creators and stuff all kind of go to a show or something of that nature, where at least there's a presence there.
That is what I'd love to do next year, is go to one of the bigger shows like Chicago or something like that, and actually, or even Baltimore or, you know, Big Apple,
Heroes.
And get Heroes Con. There you go. One is
San Diego.
Notoriously
I never
family
do.
Friendly.
San Diego, there's too many horror stories
this
year. It's way too corporate, and the comic guys are way too depressed by the amount of traffic coming in, and people were there for movies. I think WonderCon will be the new San Diego out in California.
Hmm.
I think Baltimore and Heroes Con are the two friendly throwbacks to people who really love comics. That's the ones the artists.
Yeah.
Too. I mean, artists who normally never do shows, they will show up at Baltimore. Whereas Con, it's just a much more thing. So.
Okay, well, cool. Well, best of luck at the show, and thanks for being on the Saturday Supercast. I'll make sure that all the links to the stuff we talked about are in the show notes. So, and I hope to have you on again.
Cool.
And we're all really looking forward to seeing Alfie in print as soon as you... you know, schedule the book. So, okay, well, thanks for listening, everybody.
All right.
That wraps up this week's episode of Saturday Supercast. I hope you had a good time. For more information about the stuff we were talking about, you can check out the show notes at sugarycereals.com. Remember, cereals is spelled S-E-R-I-A-L-S. The music for this podcast was recorded and performed by Umberto. You can find out more information about them at virb.com/umberto. And Sugary Cereals is published by 01 Comics. You can find out more information on them at 01comics.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, bye.